Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Redbox Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. We've made it to Friday. We've all done very well. We've got a cracking episode coming up for you today. The creator of Borgen, talking about the Danish political drama coming back. We've got James Forsyth and Melanie Reid picking over the news. But first, as we always like to do on a Friday, let's take a look at what we learned this week. So 2022 began with us all looking for certainty. But we learned there just wasn't much of it. Keir Starmer wasn't certain what his new slogan is.
The values I've outlined today of security, of prosperity, and respect. They're the three values.
After Keir Starmer had to isolate for the sixth time, Angela Rayner wasn't certain that Boris Johnson was particularly comfortable with her standing in.
Prime Minister, how's it going? Are you okay?
Common Speaker Lindsay Hoyle wasn't certain who the leader of the Lib Dems is.
Ed Ball of Ed David.
Jacob Rees-Mogg made clear at Cabinet he now isn't certain he supports the tax rise he voted for 4 months ago. But he is certain that refugees should stay in France.
I wonder how often, Mr. Speaker, France has been called safe in this particular chamber over the centuries. But I think we can accept that it is safe for most refugees, except for those who don't like garlic, who may need to escape.
What a joker. And Boris Johnson wasn't certain of anything at all. In a four-minute non-answer to a press conference question, 46 seconds were taken up with all of these uncertainties.
The numbers of doctors, 10,000 more nurses. You'll have turned to that earlier. The NHS, David. As I said, that is where we are anyway.
This stuff. It is all very clear now. Right, coming up, the big thing today is an interview with Adam Price, the creator of Borgen. Regular listeners to the podcast will know I'm a massive fan. We ran the World Cup of political TV shows and it proved very popular. So that's coming up in just a sec. But first, as ever, we kick off with our columnist panel. And they've got a new name, Formel. Does it sound like cheese? Anyway, this is Melanie Reid and James Forsyth. Let's talk about the flat and Boris Johnson's text. I mean, it's always fascinating when you get an insight. I mean, not that any of us would ever want our text messages published publicly, but Boris Johnson describing his flat as a bit of a tip in Downing Street, which is why he needed to get Lulu Little, the owner of England's last wicker workshop, rattan work, weaving workshop, on the case to clear it all up. What does this tell us both about the way that Boris Johnson operates? And is this the end of the row, do you think? Or does this open up a whole new load of bad headlines for the PM.
I think, as Steve Swinford and Henry Zefferman were pointing out yesterday, I don't think this is the end of the row, because it's going to lead to lots of questions about what Great Exhibition 2 was and what happened and all of that. So I don't think it is the end of it. I also think that there is a kind of the Boris Johnson's excuse is that, you know, he had to get not just a new phone number, but a new handset, because of his number becoming public. But I think one of the things that is so interesting about that is he resisted changing his phone number or handing his phone over for ages, because this is the way he likes to do business, firing off, you know, WhatsApps and text messages all over the place. And I think that this is, you know, and this is part of what is causing him problems right now, which is, you know, there isn't proper record keeping of that. And it means that there's no one there to say, Prime Minister, are you sure that's wise? And I think that is what has come back to bite him here. I mean, he would have been much better to have had this, have this whole process handled, you know, handled not by him. You know, if this should have been, this should all have been, you know, totally been done by people who were not himself, because that would have avoided all of these questions about, you know, what did Lord Brownlow, you know, what was going on here? Was this appropriate or not?
And I suppose that's the thing, isn't it, Melanie? Is that in most other organisations, I mean, for instance, if the carpets in the Times newsroom were a bit tatty, I'm not sure it would fall to the editor of the Times to, you know, get book the carpet man to come in and fix it and sort out the invoices and all of that. Do you know what I mean? He's supposed to be running the country.
Yeah.
And there should be a process around all the, especially when it starts being public money, donors' money and all of that. If he was just paying for it himself, then fine. Maybe he could be going through the wallpaper samples. But it just seems a very strange way to run a anything.
It smacks of entitlement a bit, doesn't it? And I think that's why people are so angry. I mean, you know, the Times inbox beneath the story, 1,900 commenters. I mean, I think people care about this because it is about entitlement. You know, that line about get in touch with you for approvals. I mean, that's like someone with a trust fund, you know, and it, what a lovely euphemism. Next time when I go to my bank manager, I'm going to say, just coming on to you for approvals. You know, life isn't like that for in the real world. Though, can I just say, I rarely feel sorry for Boris Johnson, but in this instance, I do, you know, can you imagine the poor guy going home every night with all he's got, all the people on his back, going home, and what does he get faced with but the wallpaper? he's just got no escape from it, has he? I mean, Lulu Little is all around him.
But also, I mean, James, there is a genuine, serious point about Boris Johnson. This was going on in 2020, at the height of the pandemic, when the country was, you know, when he was, we were told, you know, gripped by the data dashboards and the latest figures and the economy and the deaths and whatever else. And yet it turns out that he was using his time to try and get a mate to pay for his new sofas. Just in terms of priorities, like everyone knows, if you're having a really busy time at work, you don't start redecorating the back bedroom.
Yeah, look, I think this is all comes back to this point, which is, you know, process, right? It is clearly not a sense of, it is not for both propriety reasons, but also for the reason you pointed out, it's clearly not a sensible use of the Prime Minister's time. You know, even if we weren't gripped by COVID, even in normal times, this would not be a sensible use of his time. And I think there is a problem here, which is we kind of prided ourselves on, as a country, you know, the Prime Minister kind of lives above the shop, and, you know, it's not a presidential style system with, you know, a chef up there or anything like that. I think I wonder if it might be more sensible to kind of take this out of the control of politicians, so remove any potential for conflicts of interest, and have this handled by, you know, by somebody else. So there is a system around them which A, keeps them away from the kind of trouble that Boris Johnson has got himself into, but also frees them up to concentrate on whatever you think of the Prime Minister of the day is clearly quite an important job.
Yeah,
the problem is they probably choose John Lewis wallpaper. You know,
somebody is screaming at the radio right now, Melanie, that there's nothing wrong with John. If only I could afford John Lewis wallpaper, and that is also a fundamental problem, isn't it?
But I was talking from the Prime Minister's and Carrie's point of view. I didn't mean I agree.
But then I suppose the question is that if you're paying for it yourself, fine. If you've got the money, fine. But when you want to live that lifestyle, you haven't got the money yourself, and then you've used up all of the taxpayer allowance of your flat, and then you go round to your mate to try and do it. And there was a few weeks ago, there was a brilliant graphic at the Times where they tried to explain the way the money had gone round in circles. And then it sort of all went round in a circle, then it all came back round again because it was... it was just so complicated. James, let's broaden it out a bit more. Let's stop talking about the Prime Minister's personal finances, because you've written your column today about the slightly more important matter of the finances of everyone else in the country. And this cost of living crisis is becoming a massive, massive problem, isn't it?
Yeah, it is clearly going to be the big story of the year. And I think inflation has been low for so long that we've kind of forgotten what happens when it goes high. And it's kind of worth remembering that, you know, Margaret Thatcher in the 80s was always of the view that inflation was much more of a threat to her government than high unemployment, because while high unemployment is obviously very painful for the individuals and communities involved, but in high inflation makes everybody feel worse off. And that is a problem, and I think we're going to feel that this year is going to be dominated by this question of, you know, what are you doing to help? And the government's problem is, but obviously with taxes going up in April, people are going to feel that the government isn't helping them, and also this energy price cap. You know, you can't fix prices. So yes, the government has managed to protect consumers in the very short term, but when the regulator decides in February, it's going to put that price gap up by a huge amount. You know, so in Whitehall they are braced for that going up by 80%. That's just going to be a massive increase in people's bills, and it's going to be very, very painful for people. And I think people are going to want the government to do something to help, and the question is what.
Yes, and particularly because this is happening at precisely the time that national insurance is going up. So far from helping, it's adding to the problem. How's this playing out in Scotland, Melanie? It's always good to get a sort of take away from Westminster, away from England, because you know the prices are going up right across the country.
I think again, it's a case where the Scots are very, very aware of the reality of life. And if you know, if you're paying extra for food and fuel and national insurance are going up, then all the luxuries in life, what are the luxuries in life after you pay the essentials, and then what is left? A bit of retail, a bit of tourism, you know, booking a holiday, a new sofa, and all those things are going to go. So the Scots, I think, are less likely to live on credit. They're less likely to buy on tick. And that's why, I mean, James's suggestion in his column about scrapping tariffs on imported goods, I think it's an interesting suggestion, but I think it's limited, because people aren't going to be buying stuff other than the essentials. And that goes very much for north of the border, where there are a lot of people who are on lower incomes.
And that's going to be such a problem, isn't it, Jen? But I mean, one of the sectors that has been so badly hit in the past 2 years has been hospitality. And the first thing to go, if people are starting to feel the pinch, is, you know, discretionary spending on eating out and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I think this is, if you look at the sectors that have been worse hit, as you say, Matt, it's hospitality, it's high street retail, it's travel. And all of those things are going to get hit if people feel that they are having to cut back on their spending because money's tight. And I think the problem for the government is, you know, you can come up with all sorts of ideas about how you fix energy policy, but none of them happen quickly. And this is, I mean, this is the issue for that they're dealing with, which is, you know, what are your answers to these problems? And the painful truth when it comes to new inflation is that the government has very limited tools about how to handle this. You know, interest rates is now handled by the Bank of England, and you know, and Boris Johnson can't really affect the global price of energy, and so you are left in this very difficult position. And then add on top of that the fact that, you know, Omicron is going to, I think, be inflationary, because it's going to, you know, these shortages that it causes will push prices up further. And you can just see this is going to be a very difficult year. Some political crises kind of come out of a kind of clear blue sky. No one is expecting it. This one, it is clear as day what we are going to be spending this year talking about in politics. And I think that one of the problems with Boris Johnson is that is why you're going to have more things like Jacob Rees-Mogg and saying, you know, scrap the national insurance rise, because everyone can see what the problem coming down the line is, and everyone is going to want to set out their solution to solving it.
Melanie Reader, James Forsyth there, and of course you can read them both in the Times every week. James on a Friday, Melanie in the Saturday Times magazine, where you can also see my column in the paper on a Saturday. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timeswebbox. Up next, Borgen is back.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. Now it's time for this. Exactly 10 years ago, Britain was gripped by the politics of coalition, of deals done between unlikely political bedfellows, of high drama and low skullduggery, despite the main protagonists not speaking the same language as everyone else. No, not the Rose Garden love affair between David Cameron and Nick Clegg, but the Danish political drama Borgen, which began being broadcast on BBC 4 in early 2012. Where Scandi Noir was all about the dark murders and fancy knitwear, Borgen was all about the nitty-gritty of budget negotiations. Even so, it became a cult hit, with Politico swooning over Birgitte Nyborg and her efforts to become and then survive as stats minister. And now a fourth series is coming this year after it was snapped up by Netflix. Here to explain its success and Danish politics more generally is the show's creator, Adam Price.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
I should explain that I was a huge fan of Borgen when it emerged, but I really remember when it first landed on British TV, sitting down with my wife. It was a Saturday night, and she was like, what are we going to watch? Is it going to be Strictly? Is it going to be The X Factor? Whatever. And I said, apparently there's this new thing This new drama series. Oh, okay. Yeah, it's on BBC Four. Okay. It's political and it's Danish. And amazingly, for in a moment of weakness, she went along with it and we became completely hooked by it. Explain for people who haven't seen it, who are mad and haven't yet seen it, what the story of Borgen was all about.
First of all, I'll just say I'm so grateful that you actually gave it a chance and that you became hooked because I know it's not a very sexy pitch. I mean, a Danish show about coalition politics. That's possibly the worst pitch ever. But I do believe that the show has a universal story about the mechanics of power politics that works anywhere, I would say. And also, of course, a story about, you could say, an idealist, Birgitte Nyborg, when she begins her journey into the prime minister's office. She is actually a three-dimensional woman who has a real life, a husband, a kids. And after a few rounds of power politics, she basically loses her real life and becomes a different person. We follow that, you would say, downward spiral where she gradually loses her old wholesome life and becomes a power politician, not completely cynical, but definitely losing track of the person she is. And the premise we constantly work with the show is the question, can you remain in power and still remain true to yourself? And that's the challenge she faces in every single episode.
I mean, I think probably in tone, for people who've seen other political shows, it's more West Wing than The Thick of It. It's sort of aspirational, and that's probably why it has proved popular. You know, whatever problems people had in their own domestic politics, seeing this principled, high-minded, you know, good person trying to do the right thing has appeal. Yes. In the way that yes. West Wing did.
She does get disappointed, and she disappoints other people as well. I think actually in the fourth episode, she says to her closest advisor, I would have hoped that I would have spent more than 100 days before I would be lying openly to the general public. So, I mean, she does get her hands dirty, but I definitely wanted to write an uplifting show. Also, basically because so many shows, not only in Denmark, but also internationally, and also feature films, had at the time when I began writing Borgen, typically portrayed the political life as, you know, politicians being bad guys, cynical people, power players, only in it for their own good. And it was up to the conscientious journalist to expose the bad politician and get them sacked, basically. And I thought there must be another politician worth our time to describe, to go into, and that became Birgitte Nyborg, obviously.
You mentioned that a drama about Danish coalition politics wasn't the sexiest pitch. What drew you to it as a topic, and how hard was it to sell to Danish broadcasters?
It was quite hard, I would say, when I came to them with the not very sexy version of the show, basically saying I want to do a show about Danish coalition politics. They say go home and work on the pitch and come back. But I was driven by a want to tell a political story from my generation, basically, because my generation had been accused of being non-political in this country, because basically we were told by our parents' generation, the 68 generation that had kind of reformed the political landscape in many countries and women's lib and basically the modern society, that we were basically the parasites of their revolution, you know? We were just living off the land that they created. We were basically just prone to be the good consumers because they did the revolution. We had nothing to be, we didn't have any reason to be in politics because they did the whole thing for us. And I was actually quite provoked by this. And I thought that, hey, my generation, I mean, I grew up with these very strong images of people fighting for democracy, the rebellion at the Tiananmen Square, the falling of the Berlin Wall, these extremely strong images. And then just looking at our own little pretty democracy in Denmark, where people sometimes don't even bother to vote because we've had democracy for such a long time. So I thought democracy should be at the core of this story. you know, an idealistic, uplifting show more than just the negative classical story about the bad politician.
And how important was it for you that the prime minister or the main protagonist trying to become prime minister was a woman? Because real life got there just before you did, or no, you got there just before Helen Thorning-Schmidt basically became Danish prime minister in 2011.
Exactly, yeah. We were very lucky. Denmark, for strange reasons, actually, it didn't have a female prime minister before Helle Thorning-Schmidt came. And we were, I think, 2 or 3 months before her. So that was just a good luck on our part. But I thought it was hugely important that it was a woman. Because, I mean, I just thought that for many reasons, it would be more interesting to see a woman sacrifice everything that has to do with her private life, her love life, her relationship with the kids, with the husband, in order to fill the seat of the most difficult job on earth, basically. It would be more interesting to see a woman do that, because we have seen so many times that men let down their wives, their kids, everything to wage wars, to build businesses, to triumph politically. But we hadn't seen a woman do it in a man's world, and I thought that would be an interesting way into it. So definitely it was all important that it was a woman.
I wonder if you, in the process of doing, because I've spoken to people who've written political dramas or actors who've been in them, and their view of politicians has changed in the process of thinking about the decisions they face. And I wonder whether, and sometimes for good and sometimes for bad, and I wonder if your opinion of politicians change as a result of working through, you know, sometimes it's budget negotiations, you know, or it's trying to solve political crises overseas, prevent a conflict, whatever it might be. I just wonder if your view of politicians changed in the process of creating Borgen.
Well, I think the game has definitely changed. And I think the new season also tries to reflect on that. The game has become a faster game. It's become dirtier. And I think the politicians in the game have to change their ways about the game. And that has changed them as well. I do respect a lot of the politicians I have been able to follow and to have a series of meetings with party leaders from all, you could say, all parties of the Danish parliament. So I really tried to do a lot of research also for the new season. But I think the game has changed, as I said. And do I still have the same respect? Yes, but sometimes also in this country, even though I would say that in Denmark, we do have a lot of trust, not necessarily of the singular politician, but of the system. We really believe in the system. And I think there's a lot of proof of that. COVID lately has proven yet again that the Danes, they have a great trust of the system, not necessarily the politician in it, but definitely the system. It has made me respect certain politicians, but it has also made me loathe the game because sometimes it is so, it doesn't go for results, you know. It very often the game is about making it difficult for your opponent more than actually achieving a result, which is so sad because we don't elect them to make difficulties for each other. We elect them to make results for the country.
When we last saw Birgit, she'd launched a new centrist party. And this has, you know, got us centrists in Britain very excited, you know, that maybe something similar could happen here. And in fact, we then did in the form of what became Change UK. We had a centrist party that broke away from the Labour Party and the Conservative Party. And, you know, surged in the polls and then crashed and burned almost immediately and had absolutely no impact at all on the 2019 election. And actually what we've seen in politics is it's probably diverged more rather than sort of becoming more centrist. What's happened in Danish politics over the same period? We've seen, you know, in America it's become more polarised too. I know Danish politics less well. What's happened there?
Well, of course, we have a long tradition of a multi-party system in Denmark. And of course, you don't in the UK. And I think in the US, it has become a tragedy. It has become the First World War of trenches, basically. And I think that is really sad. We don't have that picture in Denmark at all. And we do have actually quite modern examples of political parties erupting out of nowhere and actually becoming elected. Though we've also had some terrifying crash and burns on that scene as well, which is also always super interesting. So I wouldn't say that the story of Birgitte Nyborg and her new party is altogether unrealistic in this country anyway, because it actually happened. And we also have fairly new parties in parliament at the moment that seem to be quite successful. And we will see how successful, of course, in the next election. But we have this old tradition of coalition governments and also minority governments that have to, if they want to pass bills, they have to do it across all the lines of the parties, various parties in parliament. And that is the Danish tradition. And it seems to work. And also, as I said before, there seems to be a great deal of trust in the system as such, even though we possibly dislike the one politician and another politician, but we actually trust the system.
Now, way back in June 2020, just as Times Radio launched, in fact, I interviewed Helene Thorning-Schmidt, the former Danish Prime Minister, and I asked her if she used to watch Borgen.
Well, I did watch it, but then it just became a bit... something happening in, like, they got divorced and their daughter got mental issues. And then I got very angry with it. And I told the author that I was very angry. And he explained to me that it had to be, that fiction was fiction. So I do admire that program. And I'm very happy that this is the Danish Broadcasting Association that made this program. It became world famous. And for me, I guess it was interesting because obviously they interviewed me before they made the program. There are certain things in there that reminded me of my own political career. So it's very interesting that people have found it, if Broad has finally understood what it means to have a coalition government, what it means to have minority government, stuff that I think we could never have taught the global community, but now they have an impression of what that is like.
That was Helene Thorning-Schmidt there. So Adam Price, before Christmas, I spoke to Amanda Iannucci, who famously created Veep in the US and The Thick of It in the UK. And one of the things that he talked about was how they would make up a scene for The Thick of It. And then after it had gone out on air, politicians or political people would get in touch and say, how did you find out about that? We thought we'd kept that quiet. And I just wondered whether through your interactions with people like Helene Thorning-Schmidt, you discovered that you, even when you thought you were making up entirely fictional things, that actually art imitated life, life imitated art.
Well, the funny thing is that I actually met with Helene Thorning-Schmidt before she became prime minister.
Yeah.
So I actually met her when she was chairman of the Social Democratic Party in Denmark. And the chairman is always a candidate for the prime minister's office, obviously. But I didn't meet with her when she was prime minister. But I've had the pleasure of meeting with several prime ministers, former prime ministers. And of course, you pick up stories, bits and pieces. You study, you become a political junkie, basically. You study, of course, the news every single day. You read political columns and you pick up bits and pieces. I would never take a story one-to-one and just place it in the show, because I would feel like I'm not writing documentary. I'm trying to build a meaningful drama that basically is the story about a female politician, her close colleagues, her family, and also a journalist, her colleagues, her family. So we actually have these two ways into the political life of Denmark, the journalistic and the political way into it. And the personal drama needs to make sense. It needs to have an arc. And therefore, I need to build the stories around the character more than basically hammering the character into some odd story that I happen to find in a news column. I would never do that. But I would pick bits and pieces. And then we would try always to ask politicians, what would be the next thing? What are you working on at the moment? What do you think would be a scene of great controversy or strife in parliament in the years to come? We would always try to kind of look into a crystal ball together with experts in order to be online with the latest development on various areas of politics. And we really tried to do that with the new show. It has been very difficult because things change at a much faster pace at the moment.
Yes, let's talk about that. How did it come about? It's been 7 years since, but in fact, longer than that. What was it, in 2013?
Yeah, nine years since...
It aired anyway in Denmark.
Yeah. So we actually said to each other back then that should we ever have the idea of getting the band together again, it should be because we had a very strong idea that we needed to write. We shouldn't do it just because we made a success. We should do it out of necessity for a story. And I really thought that story came. And of course, I will not reveal too much of it because that would be plot revealing for the new season. But I think there's also another reason now, which is actually quite interesting. The characters, Birgitte Nyborg and Katrine Fønsmark, the journalist, I mean, they have moved into a different chapter of their lives because they've actually become 10, 12 years older. And if you have been so long time in politics as Birgitte Nyborg has at this current hour, you have also been changed by that as a person. She's also personally in a different chapter of her life. She's now in her early 50s. And also, what does it mean for a politician when you've been in power, when you've been a powerful person in the top echelons of your party, of the parliament, in so many years? I talked to a politician who said, you know, power is like a slow working poison. It drips into your cup every day, a drop a day. And you think it's coffee, but after a while, it's not. It's just bitter.
Wow.
And it changes you. Yeah. And I think that is actually a very, it's a beautiful description of a disease, the disease of power. And how do you avoid being absorbed in it? How do you avoid becoming a different person where power becomes your primary basis of actually being in the game? You're in there for the power it gives you. And what you can do with that power, well, if you can put up some tripwires for your personal adversaries in parliament, that's possibly even more important to you than actually making results. Because you've become this old, angry lion in this game, and you don't hunt in the same way as you did when you were a young lion.
It's interesting you make that point about this, sort of the addiction to power of politicians. The interesting, yes. I think one of the differences it seems between Britain and Denmark is that actually almost all of the former prime ministers in the UK leave office and then they leave Parliament. In fact, it's only Theresa May who is still of the... We've got John Major, Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, David Cameron, Theresa May, five former prime ministers. Only Theresa May is still in politics. They all clear off and do their own thing, whether it's to make money or save the world, wherever it might be, but it's outside politics. Is there a different culture in Danish politics? Do politicians stay around for longer?
I think that there are quite recent examples of the opposite. Anders Fogh Rasmussen became a Secretary General of NATO and then left. Løkke Rasmussen, his successor, was prime minister for a relatively short time, then Helle Thorning-Schmidt came, and then he came back and actually became prime minister again. So he stayed in the game and is actually forming a new party. So quite interesting there, he has remained in politics. Helle Thorning-Schmidt left politics, took various offices in outside politics, and has now written a very successful book. So I would say some stay, some don't. There's not a rule to it. But definitely, the game has changed also for old prime ministers in this country, and it has become dirtier for them as well.
I suppose that the nature of eight political parties in the parliament, the nature of those multi-party coalitions means that, as we learnt from watching Borgen, you can feel like you're completely out of it one minute, and then something happens, and suddenly you're right back in the game again. Just like, when will we be able to see the new series of Borgen, and will COVID be a part of it? Because there were sort of so many different schools of thought with people creating drama. You know, do we want to be reminded of it? Can you pretend it didn't happen? What's your approach to it?
Exactly. Well, I actually decided that this show would have a post-COVID feel to it. So we are definitely living in a world where COVID has taken place, but it is not a subject that we constantly are talking about, and we're not wearing face masks at all times, because how would you act in a face mask? So definitely not. I thought we would be so sick and tired of it, I'm sure most people are, that I would make it a post-COVID thing. We opened the show in Denmark on the 13th of February, so quite soon. We are currently editing the very last episode of this upcoming season. Then it will be on in Denmark for 8 weeks. We've made a season of 8 episodes, and then it will be on Netflix. So I would say sometime mid-April, it will be on in 190 countries.
And how exciting is that for you? Instead of me 10 years ago having to rootle around in the dark corners of BBC4 to find it, it lands globally on what, the biggest streaming network?
Yes, and of course we're very excited about that. It's a different day and age now. I mean, back in the day when we wrote Borgen, when I began creating the show, I was told by the head of drama back then for DR Drama, the Danish Broadcasting Service, that Adam, this show will not travel. I mean, this is a show about Danish coalition politics. Maybe the Norwegians and the Swedes will buy it out of brotherly love, but that will be it. And then, of course, we began to see that, like, all of a sudden, it began to grow in other countries. It became big in the Netherlands and in Belgium and in the UK and in France and in Germany. And that was very exciting because you could see it kind of evolving. Now it will just explode out there in 190 countries and it will be a big boom, and then it's there. We wouldn't necessarily know how it will go in every single country. It's just out there on Netflix, on the big ocean, alongside with huge other series. And we will just pray and hope that our little Danish Viking ship will be the center of some attention, at least.
I'm not going to ask you what happens at the end of the series, but is there a possibility for more if it explodes on Netflix around the world in the way that you'd hope?
Well, I will say so much that we do not kill any of our... We don't have a very high body count in this show. But of course, you can die as a politician in many ways. And I will not reveal any plot details as to that yet. But I'm sure if there was a great public need for it, we would have to go back and see if there wasn't yet another idea in the top drawer.
One other thing I wanted to ask you, just Adam Price, have you ever crossed paths with the Adam Price in British politics? Former MP and now leader of Plaid in Wales.
Obviously, when you sometimes, I mean, if you Google the name, and sometimes I can see that there is a politician with my name, or I have his name. I've never met him, but the family is English. We left London 200 years ago. So there are definitely ties with the UK, but they are old and worn.
Well, there he is in the Welsh Assembly now, leading Plaid. And yeah, maybe there is a connection somewhere in the deep and distant past.
Yeah, you never know.
Adam, it's been lovely to speak to you. I'm really excited about it coming back. I really appreciate the time. Thanks so much for talking to us, Adam Price.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio, and we bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts from?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.